It often pays to believe in people more than they believe in themselves. Repeatedly, I felt I was getting responsibility that felt a little bigger than I was able to handle at the time I got it. So that to me is testimony of the people giving me that responsibility, that they believed in me more than I believed in myself. And it paid a lot for me. I hope it paid for P&G, and it shaped the way I think about talent. Yeah, I think when you and I, Drew, when we delegate an amount of responsibility to others that both they and we feel comfortable with, it's wrong because we prevent their growth. I think we should always delegate a little bit more than others are comfortable to take, and maybe even a little bit more than we feel comfortable giving them. Not much more. We shouldn't lead them into the panic zone. We shouldn't overstretch them, but we should stretch them a bit. Give them a bit more than they think they can handle, and everyone is going to be rewarded.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Ruman Segal, recovering marketer.
And I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer. Ruman and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know, but want to know more about.
It's kind of like being a fly on the wall for my mentoring coffees.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Stefan Hohmeister. We'll be exploring leadership principles and ideas through the lens of, wait for it, podcasting. That's right. Today is a podcast about podcasts. What Stefan has learned about leadership, branding, legacy, and more from recording over 300 podcast episodes. Before we chat with Stefan, here's a quick bio. Stefan Hohmeister is the founder and owner of Stefan Hohmeister Leadership, a consultancy whose focus is on improving leadership performance and strategy via consulting, training, coaching, and keynotes. He is also the host of the business podcast Lightwolf, which explores the key to leadership performance, sustainability, and improving business results through more than 300 episodes. Prior to starting his consulting company, Stefan had a diverse career as sales and marketing director of SAB Miller Europe and CMO for T-Mobile Germany, where he had P&L responsibility for more than $8 billion. And Stefan started his career at Procter & Gamble in various sales and marketing roles in Frankfurt, Brussels, and Geneva before becoming the marketing director for healthcare and pharma in DACH. He is married with two children and enjoys traveling to new places and team sports. Stefan, it is great to have you with us. Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Drew. Thank you for inviting me. Pleasure to be your guest.
Excellent. Well, so I'm very excited to talk with you today, not just about kind of some of your career and your career lessons, but also this wonderful but also challenging world of podcasting and what it means for today's leaders out there. But before we talk about podcasting, I do want to talk a little bit more about your background, because you're born and raised in Dusseldorf, which is actually not too far from where my wife grew up. So I've been there kind of in that area many a time. And I'm wondering, what was your early life like? Obviously, I've seen what, you know, her German life was like, but what was your early life like? Were there any lessons that kind of stick with you or any key moments from your childhood that kind of, you know, set you on the trajectory that you took?
Yes, indeed. So first of all, life as a kid and as a teenager in and around Dusseldorf was great. And really a childhood that I enjoyed a lot. I probably couldn't have wished for more. I'm a football player by birth. My father used to say, Stefan, you weren't even 1 year old and you wanted to play and kick around balls. So I played football and very passionately and for some time also at a certain level of quality. I love it. I love team sports. And I think it's also around that one team sport called football that I learned a lesson that in fact I learned from my mother. I was 7 years old, and it never took me more than 5 minutes to assemble a football team on the road. So I needed 5 minutes to have 20 people on the left side of the road playing against 20 people from the right side of the road, and we played. We played until after sunset. And one night, a neighbor of ours, who was a little bit annoyed by the noise we made, she called the police. So the police is coming, two men looking down at us, looking down at my eyes and telling us off that we are not allowed to play football here, right? And I somehow felt this guy feels mixed. He's doing his job because he has to, but he felt uneasy telling us off. But fine, we left the pitch for 3 minutes, waited until the police had gone, and then we went back on and continued playing. And then the next day, I did something that was maybe controversial, to say the least. I bought something that in German is called Stinkbombe. It's a small little glass container filled with a liquid that once the glass opens, it really smells horribly. And I decided with two of my mates to smash it against the door of this annoying neighbor and then just deny any responsibility. When the neighbor knocked on my mom's door and said, "Mrs. Hohmeister, this is what happened to me. And I think your son was involved, right?" I just denied and straight out lied to my mom for about an hour. Mm-hmm. After an hour, my mom knew me well. I just gave up, confessed, and expected a severe punishment. Mm-hmm. But none of that happened, Drew. In fact, she didn't get any louder or assertive. All the opposite. She lowered her voice and said, "Stefan, fine. And now you're going to go up and apologize." So we went up. She accompanied me. We rang the doorbell. I confessed. I even offered 10 Deutschmarks, my residual pocket money, to pay part of the damage. But that was it. And no more fuss, no more threat, no more punishment afterwards. And I think, Drew, the lesson I drew from this is very profound. Because in that moment, my mom taught me, you can make big mistakes and you will never be punished as long as you take personal responsibility for the consequences of your behavior. So that's the lesson I learned in Düsseldorf from my own mother playing football.
Wow. I mean, it seems so, as a relatively new father, I have a 2.5-year-old, it seems like, I don't know if I'm thinking in the future or like 5 years from now, do something like the immediate instinct is like punishment and you're grounded and I can't believe you did this and you're going to scrub it. And not only that, but you also lied to me for an hour about it, all these other things. But, you know, I think there's something, and maybe some kids or, you know, some people might need that type of thing. But it seems like your mom also knew you particularly well to say like, okay, yeah, you're going to learn. This is going to be a memorable moment for you. It's going to alter your behavior to not do it again in the future because of this compassion or this understanding and recognizing that you recognize that it was wrong. What a wonderful lesson.
It's a wonderful lesson for me as a father. Like you, I have kids. I have two boys. And it's also a wonderful lesson that continued in my time at P&G. I mean, Drew, you also were at P&G. One of the things that I really love about P&G is, in those 18 years, if I include the internship, believe me, I made many mistakes. But no single time in my time in P&G did I ever feel punished. Yes, I always tried to make it a habit to be honest and also to take responsibility. But I never ever felt punished for the mistakes I made at P&G. So I think a valuable lesson I learned initially from my own mother.
Yeah, and that continues on for sure. And so, you know, I do want to talk a little bit about your time at P&G, but prior to getting there, you earned your degree in business administration from Cologne University, as well as your Diplom Kaufmann, which I think is like the equivalent of a MBA, essentially, kind of here in the U.S. So I'm curious, what was it either about the degree or your childhood? Like, how did you choose business as the route to go as opposed to, you know, professional footballer or stink bomb maker?
Yeah. Yeah, the latter one is not yet a paid career, I think. The first one is, and in fact, again, around the age of 7, 8, my career plan was pretty clear, Drew. I would be a part-time pilot at Deutsche Lufthansa, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And I would be a part-time football professional at my home club, Fortuna Düsseldorf, which I became a member of first time at the age of 6. So Thursday and Friday practice, Saturday a Bundesliga game, Sunday a day off. Mm-hmm. That was the plan. That was the career plan at the age of 8. And then life came in between. Mm-hmm. So how did I choose it? I finished my A-levels and then had time at the military service to really reflect. And I kind of rationally thought, because I didn't know yet at the time what I really have passion for in terms of profession at the age of 17, 18. Mm-hmm. But I thought, okay, Stefan, you're not bad at math. You're not bad at languages. And you like engaging with people. So studying business sounds like an opportunity to leave many doors open while at least taking a broad direction. So I studied business again, I admit, I studied in Cologne. The first two semesters I didn't like at all. I wasn't sure at all that I was in the right movie. Only in the third semester when I suddenly found marketing and trade and sales. And I also met P&G, to be honest. All these things happened closely connected. That's when I knew I seemed to be in the right study field. And I accompanied this with language. So I always studied French or English or Russian language, business language, commercial language, accompanying my main studies. So that's how it came about. I was a mediocre student at first, but then in the last year, I would say I really focused on it and then graduated quite nicely and then enjoyed it.
Yeah. And would you say that the becoming a better student was connected to finding that marketing or sales angle where you had more passion or interest in it? Was that part of what prompted the like, oh, I should do better at this?
That is one of the two things that prompted it. The interest in marketing and the interest in retailing and sales. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was the desire to prove myself what I'm capable of. Because when I'm honest, I think in the first half of my studies, I did what was necessary. Mm-hmm. Yes, I also had to invest time into making money because I had to generate the money to pay my life. Mm-hmm. So it took some time that otherwise I could have invested into studying. But I studied kind of just enough to get through. But then in the second half of the study, so in the master part, I really wanted to prove it to myself. I wanted to find out what I'm capable of. And then I stopped playing football. I stopped making money. I really focused on studies because I wanted to know what I'm capable of. And that second driver also contributed.
Yeah. No, I think it's a very powerful driver when you can. I mean, that's what also a lot of times people talk about with the idea of like exercise. If you can get the mindset less of you're exercising because you have to and more about one, general health, but also to see like exercise is a celebration of what your body can do. Is what I've kind of heard people kind of talk about. And so that same kind of mindset of like, what a great motivator if it's less external motivation than this internal motivation and be like, what am I capable of? What can come of this? Which I think is wonderful. So you do all that and you start to learn about P&G. You do an internship at P&G. What was it about either the internship or what you kind of learned from them that made you pick to go to P&G after you graduated?
I think it was so obviously and tangibly different from the other alternatives I had. Since I went straight from school to military, from military to university, I was slightly nervous about not having enough practical experience. So I did 7 internships during my study times. And I would say 2 of the 7 were really great, while the other 5 were more kind of average administrative tasks, less demanding. But P&G was one of the two, and in fact, the one that was most different. After 5 minutes into P&G, Drew, I heard the following words. Stefan, no, don't say Mr. X. I am Andrew. And second, you know, here in P&G, you'll have 3 months. After those 3 months, we'll make a choice whether or not we make you an offer. We are also aware that you will make a choice whether or not you want to join us. And by the way, we'd like you to get familiar and comfortable with giving and receiving feedback. Because after 6 weeks and after 12 weeks, you will receive feedback and you will also be invited and requested to give feedback about the performance of your boss. And Andrew, that one statement showed me so much how differently P&G ticked compared to the other work experiences I had made prior to that I immediately felt this is different, this is special. And I realized that the work that I was given as an intern was not invented to keep an intern busy, but it was carved out of a business agenda that otherwise would have been performed by an employed manager. And that made me feel appreciated, challenged, and taken seriously. So that's what made me choose P&G, and maybe also a funny experience afterwards, because I did a seventh internship after the P&G internship in another company that you well know, also consumer goods. And one day there is a marketing director coming into the floor, open space, and shouting at one of the brand managers, "Why on earth have you done this? Had you ever tried this at P&G, you would never have gotten through with this," right? So he compared his own talent pool against what he himself, being a P&G alum, had experienced at P&G. And I went like, well, if these people here in this company really envy P&G so much, that seems to be another good reason to start my career at P&G. And then I was lucky enough. I applied 7 times. I had 7 offers. So I had the opportunity to make a well-informed choice and a good choice. But the choice was easy. Mm-hmm. I felt best. I felt challenged. I felt rewarded. I felt I had the biggest opportunity to grow, at least in the first part of my career, in P&G.
Yeah. Well, very funny. Yeah. If you're working somewhere and their benchmark is the other company that you're considering, if they're like, if we're going to be here, right, you'd be like, well, let me just go to that one. And I had a similar experience, that idea of, you know, you get responsibility right away and it feels a little bit overwhelming at first, but then you very much appreciate the projects are real projects, that the management is very real. And I think there is something very, especially for new talent. So this is for, you know, potential leaders of organizations listening to this, is that understanding of like the power that comes from saying, hey, we're going to give you feedback, but also we expect feedback from you. Like that it was very much a respect thing. It doesn't matter that you're an intern or that you haven't been here and, you know, these people are established, et cetera. You know, P&G is very much a first name basis for every single person that's there. There's a level of respect where you're like, oh, I'm wanted here and I provide value here as well, which I think is a great way to, you know, bring someone new, either whether it's an intern or a new hire into the fold, is you're giving them that kind of responsibility right away. And as you can see, you know, from both of our stories, it has a long-term impact on how people feel about the organization. And so you say, yep, you get the internship offer, you say yes, and have a, you know, a wonderful career at P&G. Any lessons that stand out to you from P&G that still inform and perhaps some of the ways that you lead as, you know, in the consultancy that you do now?
Yeah. Maybe 2 or 3 that I would highlight. Mm-hmm. First, it often pays to believe in people more than they believe in themselves. Repeatedly, I had the impression that throughout my career, being promoted 6 times, taking a young general management role at the end, leading 650 people in 3 countries, repeatedly I felt I was getting responsibility that felt a little bigger than I was able to handle at the time I got it. So that to me is testimony of the people giving me that responsibility, that they believed in me more than I believed in myself. And it paid a lot for me. I hope it paid for P&G, and it shaped the way I think about talent. And it shaped the way how I think about frequent leadership tasks like delegating responsibility. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when you and I, Drew, when we delegate an amount of responsibility to others that both they and we feel comfortable with, it's wrong. It's wrong because we prevent their growth. I think we should always delegate a little bit more than others are comfortable to take. Mm-hmm. And maybe even a little bit more than we feel comfortable giving them, a little bit more. Not much more. We shouldn't lead them into the panic zone. We shouldn't overstretch them. But we should stretch them a bit. Give them a bit more than they think they can handle. And everyone is going to be rewarded. So that's one of the things I've taken away. The other one I've taken away is explore different kinds of assignments. In fact, the reason that you and I are now meeting here in the context of leadership goes back to one moment at P&G, and it goes back to one question. I was a brand manager on Vizier and Dash, 2 mid-price detergent brands, 280 million euros of sales, 6 wonderful young brand people to lead. And I had a strategy on Vizier and had that in our typical one-page memos, 3 options, 1 reco, 3 reasons to my boss. Within 30 minutes, he came back, circled my recommendation and asked, Stefan, are you sure you're fully aware of the implications that that strategy will have on the sales and market share you'll have in your biggest client called Edeka Germany? And Drew, I looked into his face, and I had no idea. I had no clue. Why? Because I had no clue about sales. So about 3 minutes later, I ran across to the Edeka department, got about an hour of download of education and sales training. Mm-hmm. Coming back to my place, I changed my strategy because I suddenly realized the damage I would have done with that strategy to the business at our biggest client. And then I raised my hand saying, guys, and this was in the 90s, it's the first time that P&G starts staffing multifunctional customer teams. Mm-hmm. Like in the US, it was long established. Walmart teams would be multifunctional. And in that Edeka team, you don't have a marketing multifunctional resource yet. Mm-hmm. So please, if ever you staff that role, assign me to that role. So I wanted to go into sales. I spent 2 years in sales. I learned a ton. I had a vertical part of my learning curve. I ran a client. So I really had sales responsibility. I had people responsibility for 15 people. And I learned sales. I'm far from being a long-term sales expert, but I have enough understanding of sales that I can help assess whether a sales strategy is off or on. And looking at the rest of my career, this sidestep into a sales assignment initially without people responsibility was a huge accelerator on my career long term.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where there's maybe an instinct or belief like, no, if I take this sidestep, right? Because I was managing people to go to not managing people or whatever. It seems like either a demotion or that it's a lateral move and it's not going to progress, but it gives you that rounded perspective, right? That understanding of like, hey, here's a little bit of a gap and I need to at least know what I don't know to be able to ask those questions. And what a wonderful question to come back to give you to be like, hey, this theoretically looks good on paper, but did you know? And wasn't, that's also another example of, I think, great leadership is it wasn't, Stefan, you're an idiot. This is never going to work. You cannot do that because it's going to, you know, have this implication. It was like, have you thought about this so that you can like, you know, so that forces the, you know, analytical thinking and reasoning and everything back on your side. So a number of wonderful kind of lessons within that. And so as you talk about your career, right, you go from, you learn about these things, you ultimately move on to T-Mobile Germany at one point, SAB Miller, and then start your own kind of consultancy. What was the thinking for other people that have gone through career transitions and potentially even thinking about, hey, I've done this kind of corporate work for other people for a while. What went into the process of being like, no, I want to go this direction. I want to start working for myself and teach other people about leadership. How did that come up?
I think it was an evolution, Drew. It came in steps and then culminated in one moment. I think it started with that moment back in 1995, when my director, Michael Bernhorster, let me share his name, raised this question on Vizier. Because the next morning when I came home from jogging, I went like, wow, there was something I hadn't seen yet. Mm-hmm. This is not just about leading brands. This is about leading people. And that was such a profound lesson for me to compare his behavior to the behavior of others who had, in fact, in similar situations, like you say, Drew, instructed me rather than asked me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt tight-jacketed and micromanaged by others who instructed specific solutions rather than asking me for implications that I went like, wow. So that was one of the moments that started intriguing me for leadership. Mm-hmm. Later on, I observed my own father in a moment that I only decoded later. So my dad and I just walked the streets in our hometown and come by a young man who apparently worked in my father's group in the steel industry. Mm-hmm. And then he turned around and said, Herr Hohmeister, could you stop for a moment? I have something very important to share with you. And I felt that that's very personal between the two. So I stepped away and let them share this moment alone. And I have the impression that all this young man did was thanking my father for teaching him, for helping him become who he was. And that was another moment when I felt like, wow, if such a young man stops and pauses to just thank my father, there must be something in coaching, in helping, in leading yourself and others. And I think the last moment, and it iterated. Yeah, I mean, in P&G, I was blessed to then teach leadership. In 1997, I think it was, some of our really great HR leaders asked, is anyone around who'd like to design a better leadership course? We at P&G, we have the reputation to train good managers and leaders. But the leadership training we have, pretty mediocre. Should we do a better one? And I just raised my hand and I said, I'm in. Mm-hmm. So I then coupled up with colleagues. We designed a new, apparently quite good training. And twice or three times a year, I took 2 days out of my line time and trained leaders on leadership. Mm-hmm. Apparently, it became so good that in 2002 and 3, we were then asked, and my partner was Doreen Chow from Vancouver, from HR. And we as a tandem then trained all general managers in P&G Europe, including Paul Polman, who ran Europe, on leadership. And I will never forget that one day when we trained Paul and 10 GMs, at the end of the day, he came back and said, Doreen, Stefan, really great choice. Well done. Now I have a question for you. I mean, you taught us today on one-to-one leadership on how to lead people. You know, I'm running 14,000. Can you help me translate the learning from one-to-one onto 1 to 14,000? And I looked like you, Drew. I smiled. I couldn't believe that our European leader was asking this question, but he asked it with genuine curiosity, although he is such a great personality and such a great leader. That showed to me how genuine the interest in leadership is in P&G. That was another moment. Mm-hmm. And then the final one was when in 2013, after my third company, SAB Miller, being a part of Six, running Europe, 22 countries, 12,000 people, having a great assignment, I asked myself a question that may sound odd at first. And I asked it not from the present forward, but from the end of my life backwards. I asked myself, when one day I'll die and I look back on my life, what will I have regretted more? Will I regret more not to have done 15 or 20 more years as a GM or a board member in the corporate world? And I enjoyed my time in corporate. I had fun in the corporate world. Or will I regret more not having really tried to create a leadership company? And I chose the second, which was obviously much more risky. I was in the middle of my 40s. I had a family. I had 2 kids. It was not a no-brainer, Drew. Huh? Mm-hmm. And I knew that I had about 60,000 competitors in DACH alone who sell any kind of service under the headlines of leadership, management, coaching, training, you name them. But I dared, and I'm glad I did, because we've had a good ride in the last 11 years.
Yeah. Well, there's, I think, a number of wonderful lessons kind of in that journey. And I think first of which is, you know, for people who are thinking about what do they do next? Have they tried it, et cetera? Sometimes people also ask that same thing of me, like, how did you decide to leave P&G? P&G, in particular, some of these corporate jobs, they are challenging and interesting, but there's also a certain level of comfort and security that comes from having that type of role. And so to give that up, like you said, you were like, you know, when I left, I was in my late 20s and no kids or family or anything like that. So the risk was probably a little bit lower for me. You're like, oh, how do I leave this comfort and security? But you know, it's very rarely ever a singular moment all by itself where I, you know, flipped the table and stormed out and like, that was it. It's a lot, you said, no. It's more of these steps, these iterations of like, yeah, this lesson here and this impact here. And I'm thinking a little bit about it. And I similarly asked, I had a couple of questions that I asked myself prior to leaving. And one of the big ones was that same thing of like, yeah, when you're old and gray, what will you regret more? And so I think that's a wonderful framing to think about things, because at least if you look at people who talk to a lot of like who work at end of life and things like that, and they've read books or done studies on it, is a lot of times their regrets are much more around, you know, what do people regret not doing more so than they regret what they did. And so I think that's a wonderful question to kind of ask and think about. So for people that are like, I'm not sure what to decide, one data point, not saying it's the only data point, but one data point is that wonderful question that you have shared. And so, you know, as you mentioned, it's been a good ride. It's been successful, right? You've worked with a number of incredible clients and done some fantastic work. And as part of that, you've also started a podcast that now has, you know, 300 plus episodes that's partly distilling down some of these leadership lessons that you share and that you consult on. And so why a podcast? Where did Light Wolf, you know, initially come from? What was the reason for doing so?
It all started in 2017 when our young social media agency at the time, young Frederick, I think he was 22 or 23 at the time, said, Stefan, working with you, you've learned so much. You have so many things you could share. you should do a podcast. Drew, I admit, at the time, I didn't even know what a podcast was. So I went back, Frederick, I should do what, please? And he said, Stefan, okay. A hear book, an audio book. I say, okay, I get it. A book I can hear. Got it. I like it. I like the idea because I enjoy listening to content. Therefore, I tried it. So we just did one, 31 downloads in the first month, and no idea whatsoever what that meant. At that time, there were maybe 1,000 podcasts out there in Germany. Today, there are 25,000. So the medium exploded. A year later, we had 600 downloads, then 2,000, then 5,000. And last year in June, we had more than 13,000 downloads in one single month. So it just kept on rising. The quality ratings seem high. We get higher and higher up in the charts, and more people come back to me unpromptedly sharing how much they value the podcast. So that's how it came about. And maybe also sharing some lessons, like what I learned in working with David Taylor, for example, or I had 1 year working with Steve Jobs, launching the very first iPhone outside the United States. So maybe you remember it was in your childhood, Drew, but in 2007, the iPhone was launched in the United States in February. Mm-hmm. And then Steve Jobs picked Germany, so my country, and T-Mobile, so my company, and I was the CMO, to launch the iPhone in country one outside the US. And that collaboration with Apple and Steve Jobs, and also working with him for a day live, taught me a lot of lessons about strategy, about leadership, about change, that were another reason why I thought starting a podcast might be a good idea. And now I'm glad I've done it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So it's kind of a outlet to share some of this knowledge, right? It's another form to kind of get this wisdom out there. So it's not just through one-on-one conversation. It's not just through, you know, can be through writing a book or, you know, articles or things like that. And so podcast is another way to, I think, disseminate information to 13,000 people in 1 month, right? And that continues to grow and get bigger. And, you know, I was listening to a podcast recently, and one of the things they talked about is there's an intimacy that comes with podcasting, because a lot of times people do it, you know, they do it in their home when they're washing dishes, or on their commute when it's just them by themselves, or they listen to it while, you know, walking their dog or that kind of thing. Whereas like a book, you're typically like set, hey, I'm set reading a book. Like there's a certain intimacy. And I think also like the audio from it comes, you get a sense, like, you know, the person in some ways a little bit better. So it's a wonderful kind of format kind of around that. And like you said, it's a great way to kind of distill information, which I think, I want to talk certainly about some of the lessons about like Wolf and where that comes from. But if you're thinking about, you know, if you think about other people, like, is someone, so Frederick recommended, hey, you should start a podcast. Like, do you think, are you at the point, because it feels like in some ways, like almost everyone has a podcast or has been on a podcast. Like, what's your take on that? Like, should, if you're a leader in an organization, should you start a podcast, or should you look to be a guest potentially on podcasts? Is it for everyone, or is it only if people have something to kind of say? Any thoughts on not just being a listener of a podcast, but potentially being a guest and or host of one?
Great question. I think podcasting is for you to be a guest, like me being your guest today, if you feel you can add value. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to add value to your journey and to Raman's journey on the PNG Alumni podcast. And I think it's your medium if you feel comfortable speaking. I think that's the requirement for you to be comfortable to be a guest on a podcast. And I think if you have that to an even higher degree, then it might be worth considering to run your podcast. It is, though, something that in my experience, don't know how you feel about this, Drew, because you're running your podcast also since years. Over time, it becomes a certain time commitment. Mm-hmm. And it's also a financial commitment. I'm investing about 3 to 4 hours a week into capturing ideas that often generate out of conversations like the one we are having right now. I might have new ideas right afterwards. Mm-hmm. Taking them down, turning them to titles, turning them into scripts, scrapping some of them, improving some of them, developing new series, really thinking it through, planning it through, and then creating the content, running the content, producing it here at this table. And then I have a team of two, who manage both the audio, the video, the publishing, the distribution, the technicalities. So it's also a financial investment that in my business now is 5 digits a year. So I think you have to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have to enjoy the medium, the speaking, the listening, the conversation, and doing it like I do. I think it's worth it if you feel you can really give value to many people who like listening to you. Then it might be for you. I'm not sure it's for everyone. I also admit there are some kinds of podcasts I like listening to more than others.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of podcasts I really enjoy listening to. Some others are not really for me. So I think it depends a little bit on who you are and what you want to achieve. But if you like speaking, if you like sharing, if you feel comfortable with the medium, and if you have a business reason that requires you to be in touch with many at the same time, then maybe doing a podcast is for you.
Yeah. But I think that what a great kind of thoughtful answer to kind of go through, because I think like anything in life, yeah, there's a could do, but it does also more work than I think people realize, because a podcast in some ways, it feels like, oh, well, you just decided to have a conversation and you hit record. And it's like, no, there's a lot of planning and strategy goes in, at least for the ones that I think tend to be better. Right. There are probably plenty of people that are just like, all right, it's Tuesday at 5. We're going to, you know, sit here and talk. But it's like, no, there's, you know, you're thinking about the topic and you're scripting, or at least, you know, kind of mapping it out. For our conversations that we do on Learnings from Leaders, we, you know, I do the research on who the person is and learn a little bit more about them and kind of think about what questions or what their expertise is going to be interesting. You know, we have the kind of call to talk about technology. So it's not just showing up and hitting record. There is some work to it. So you got to be willing to put that in. Like you said, there is a time investment, and to get it actually out there can be a cost investment. But like you said, the one to many is very good. If you're not someone, you know, writing a book is very hard and takes a lot of discipline of sitting down, and it can be a very kind of like lonely endeavor because it's just you and the screen or you and the paper or typewriter or whatever. So if like writing a book isn't your style, as a leader, podcasting could be an interesting way to disseminate information out to a larger organization. Or if you are running, you know, your own organization as an entrepreneur, et cetera, could be another way of like, hey, let me get some of these ideas out there and to explore them. So I love that as a measured thing to explore. And yeah, it can be much easier to be a guest on a podcast than it is to say, I'm going to take on all of the work of hosting it. And that way you can kind of share some of that knowledge and insight out there. So I love that kind of as a perspective. And so obviously you've gone the route of producing it. You call the podcast Light Wolf, which like that's part of it of like, if you're going to develop a podcast, what do you actually call it? Where did the name Light Wolf come from? What does that kind of represent?
Back in March 2009, I started laying the foundations for our own company. And I admire people who have the skill to make the complex simple, and the simple, exciting. I think that's a huge gift that some people possess. And I'm trying to learn from that. So I thought, leadership is such a wide field and so many facets and so complex. Probably you and I could spend the next 5 years not getting bored talking about great examples of leadership, Drew.
Mm-hmm.
We won't invest the time. So I was looking for something that ideally in one word and in one picture, condenses a lot of what leadership is in just one visualization.
Mm-hmm.
And I had about a 10-minute brainstorm with Tanya, my wife, over a cup of coffee, went down into my office, and then I just shouted out and jumped up in joy, so much so that Tanya went to the escalator asking, hey, honey, are you okay? And I said, Tanya, more than okay, I got it. We call this podcast Light Wolf. Why? It's one word, and it symbolizes a lot of what good leadership stands for in my mind. Yes, the first association of wolves often is strength.
Mm-hmm.
Many people know that wolves hunt to survive, but not so many people know the enormous levels of emotional and social intelligence of wolves.
Mm-hmm.
It's a family where you often have a male and a female leading a pack. Often they lead from behind not from the front. Before they start hunting, they install a kindergarten, literally. Yeah, they ask a 2 or 3 year old animal to take care of the puppies before the pack starts the hunt. They long understood the concept of diversity, age diversity. If a pack of only young wolves goes hunting, then only 1 in every 5 hunts is successful. And that's risky for a pack because they invest a lot of time, a lot of energy, and if they don't feed for so long, it can be risky to the survival of the pack. While as soon as there is 1 older wolf in the pack, every 2nd hunt is successful. So they know gender diversity intuitively. And I met a wolf. I met 3 young wolves who grew up in the wild, and I met them physically, right? I was running a light wolf program with 12 top leaders, running a 7,000 people company up in northern Germany. And I knew there was a small zoo, but with huge areas. And there were 3 young wolves, about 3 years old, siblings. And it was possible to at least see them and maybe even get close to them. So I was then observing them for 1 hour. Importantly, I saw them being fed. When they feed, they are aggressive. They don't even know siblings, right? They are loud. They show the aggressive side of a carnivore, of a wild animal. But after being fed, they were cool, calm, collected, and I observed them. And then I asked the lady who looks after them, Mrs. Ascani, do you think I'm strong enough to go into that cage? And she looked at me and said, you know, Stefan, there have been a couple of men here where I would immediately say no, right? They come here, they rattle the cage, they shout at the animals, like, come on over here, come on here, show yourself to me. This kind of aggressive, assertive behavior just causes stress for the animal. But you come across differently. You don't radiate stress. So if you feel confident, go in. So I did. There was a bench. And I immediately sat down on the bench because I didn't want to be above these animals, but I wanted to be on eye level. And I had high blood pressure in these moments, Drew. Believe me, I probably had a 300 pulse. I was stressed, but I also decided I'm not going to say a word. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to take any decision. These animals will take all decisions. So I just sat there and waited. The first came around, looked at me from about 5 meters distance and found me very boring. There was still a piece of fresh meat on the ground. He took it and walked away. The second one came much closer to about 20 centimeters of distance, sniffing my hand and then turning away. But the third one was really interested, probably as stressed as I was, but very interested, and stood about 1.5 meters away from me. We had eye contact like you and me right now, right? 1.5 meters, probably for a minute. That to me felt like a month. I was nervous, but I didn't say a word. And then after this 1 minute, the wolf lowers his ears, then lowers his head, comes forward in between my legs, comes up, and then licks square through my face, which is called the kiss of a wolf, which in a wolf's pack means, you buddy, you are okay, you're accepted as a part of this pack. And believe me, Drew, had I known this, I would have asked someone to hold a smartphone and at least right. Take a photo or take a video. Unfortunately, I didn't. I didn't see it coming, but I will keep these moments in me lifelong. And this taught me another important, profound lesson on leadership. What you send returns. I knew it in humans. I don't know. You said you travel. You like traveling. Me too. Last time I traveled to a country where I'm far from speaking the language was in Myanmar in 2018. Mm-hmm. I often make it a habit to walk through a country and smile into people's faces just to see what happens. And almost every single time when I smile at them, the smile returns. Yeah? So what you send to others returns to you. An important leadership lesson. But in that moment with the wolves, I learned it's not only humans mirroring human behavior, but even wolves mirror human behavior. And this guy adopting me just demonstrated so much resilience because he knows that I can be dangerous for him, right? Mm-hmm. So much resilience, so much respect, and so much meeting me on eye level that to me confirms the enormous level of social and emotional intelligence of these animals, which is another reason why I think it's a great symbol for leadership. If we were as socially and emotionally intelligent as wolves are, if we were taking care of our teams as much as wolves take care of their puppies and their teams, walking behind the pack, not walking in front, then I think some companies would be better off.
Yeah. Well, what a fantastic kind of one story. And I mean, I guess it's a good thing that the podcast was about wolves and not like crocodiles, because, you know, go and try to meet three crocodiles might have been a very, very different story.
That's a one-time experience.
Yeah, but a wonderful kind of thing to share. But I'm curious, so that you have this moment, and I do the same thing with my wife. This is, I think, one of the things that I very much appreciate. You know, for me, I know that I was looking for in relationships with someone that I could bounce ideas off of and that would make them stronger, et cetera. And so I appreciate that. But like, did you already know all this stuff about wolves? Like, because you know quite a bit now at this point. Like, did you know all this stuff when you're like, yes, light wolf is like the perfect thing for it? Or where you're like, okay, I think I have some concepts and let me make sure that this metaphor kind of holds true. And then like, as you learn more and more about wolves, you're like, oh yes, this does fit. Or had you already known all that?
I think I knew part of it. Mm-hmm. I had known parts of it. And I have always liked dogs, for example. I've never possessed one because I would feel guilty of leaving them behind when I go travel on vacation.
Yeah.
But I've always felt comfortable with dogs. And I have learned about wolves already before my encounter with the wolf, before being adopted into this pack. So I partly knew before I made the choice, and I partly learned more. I'm still learning. I think I'm still at the beginning of my learning about wolves.
Yeah.
I kept on learning after making the choice that this would be a really good brand name for leadership.
Yeah, which I think is a lot of times how brands work. It starts as kind of initial instinct and knowing a little bit. Because it's the other thing about wolves is I think a lot of times there's a misconception of call it like the lone wolf. The idea like it even is like, oh, you know, I don't work in teams. I'm the lone wolf out there. And it's like, no, there's not really a lone wolf. It's more of a lead wolf, right? The kind of translation light wolf of there is like maybe an alpha or someone that's a little bit more in charge, but it's not about doing things completely on your own. And so to have that insight and kind of that knowledge. And then also like as you learn it or as you do it, you can find more connections. And I think, you know, just as an aside from a branding exercise of things that we've worked with, and any decision, maybe more broadly, is like what you do after you make a decision is what determines whether or not it was quote unquote the right decision. Because and especially in moments like this, where there's not necessarily like a wrong decision of what to call the podcast. I mean, there's probably some terrible names to choose from, but, you know, to be like, oh, okay, well, this becomes really the strong name for it. Not because you've just chosen it, but you've chosen now, you know, you made the decision afterwards to say, okay, let me learn even more about what this means and more insights and more reasons why the wolf is actually a great representation of leadership. And let me go and actually visit some wolves and see. And yeah, you didn't know that they're going to lick your face, but you at least put yourself in that position to be like, I'm going to go learn and observe and see all of it. And it, you know, turns into kind of this beautiful story. And so, and light wolf is that German for lead wolf?
It is.
It's and so the podcast itself, more than 300 episodes, getting close to 400. Half of them are English, half of them are in German. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is one harder than the other just from a leadership perspective? There's one like, or is it, well, you know, both of them so well, like, I don't know, like how does the reason why I ask this or what I'm thinking about is I'm, you know, slowly, very slowly trying to learn German. It's very terrible. And we were in Germany and I was like practicing because I told my wife I was going to have a conversation with a stranger. And I was like, you know, maybe I'll talk to a receptionist or something at a hotel, I'll try to get a little bit of practice. And so I turned to her and I was like, you know, I picked a receptionist at a hotel as a person to kind of have this conversation with, because I was like, you know, I'm probably not going to have to talk about my hopes and dreams in German, right? Like it's a very transactional conversation. But like, just to be sure, I asked my wife, I was like, how would I say hopes and dreams in German? And she was like, you wouldn't. She's like, just like, we would not talk about hopes and dreams, never to a hotel receptionist, certainly, et cetera. But like that phrasing or whatever, she doesn't really sit with or talk a ton about. So do these concepts, you know, directly translate into another language? Is there a little bit of a change? Do you modify the lessons that you're sharing when you're changing the language at all, or are they universal?
What a great question. Honestly, Drew, let me answer this on two levels. The first one is, what is more difficult? And the first thought I had was from a language perspective. And maybe it sounds a bit strange because you can hear by my accent that I'm not an American or English native. I'm German native. I'm German and Swiss by nationality. But my business brain ticks English, probably because of growing up at P&G. I never forget how difficult a time I had being a CMO and general manager at T-Mobile Germany, suddenly having to write business communication in my mother tongue. It felt really odd to me. And that stays until today. So in fact, I have a slightly easier time to script, to speak, to record an English-speaking podcast. I often start with the English version and then work back into my mother tongue. So that's the language level. And I think, you know, on the second level you just touched on, which is content, concepts, I think most, if not all, of the sheer content that I think makes good leadership is universal and global.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have to be careful, though, is certain words. Let me pick an example. And one of my executives, I've done maybe 250 executive individual coachings as part of my work over the last 15 years. One of these gentlemen, in a coaching conversation, made me aware of the fact that the word consequence in English,
mm-hmm,
may sound a bit odd. It's more the word consistency that you would use in English, right? To be consistent.
Ah, okay. Yep.
Yeah. But in German, the word consistent and consequent have two slightly, but importantly, different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
To be consistent is just technically to be compatible with each other. That information is compatible with each other.
Mm-hmm.
While consequent means to get the right thing done, even if uncomfortable.
Mm.
Interestingly, that word doesn't really exist in English. So it's basically consistency in English, which captures both aspects of it. So that's an example where indeed you need to think twice,
mm-hmm,
about the word you use to communicate the concept. So that's maybe one. And the other aspect I would like to highlight is cultural differences in communication. Again, a lesson I learned at P&G, I'll never forget. I'm 3-4 months into P&G. I'm part of a meeting with 6 or 7 managers. I'm the only non-Anglo-Saxon in the room. There are a few Englishmen, a few American colleagues, and me. And we talk about two contents, content A and content B. And in my little mind, I think I have said the same thing the same way, like all those 6 partners here in the room, but I'm not having any impact whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I say A, B, and nothing happens. While everyone else around me connects A and B, and they all are very engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And then reflecting about this, Drew, a few hours later, it suddenly dawned on me. I suddenly got it. Being German,
mm-hmm,
being socialized in German schools to critical thinking, which you might also call exception hunting,
mm-hmm,
critical thinking, I said A, but B. So I differentiated. Yeah. While my Anglo-Saxon colleagues in the room said A and B, which for a critical German scientist may sound like a contradiction because A and B are not identical,
mm-hmm,
while to your ears as an American citizen and being socialized more in the United States, it sounds very logical. So this one word changing from A but B to A and B was a lesson I learned how to have influence in a global and international environment in terms of language, just changing one single word. So knowing cultural backgrounds and not just talking the language I want to talk, but using the language that my audience is used to using and listening to, doing that translation work for them is another one that sometimes when doing the Lightwolf podcast in German versus English, I have to take care of. And I even have, we have a growing population of hardcore fans. I have had a CEO, P&G alum, who is running a big company, 6,500 people. And he called me one day saying, Stefan, I listened to your podcast on topic A and I listened to it in German and in English. But you know, Stefan, in your English version, you said it slightly differently. So it's terrific to have fans who listen to the podcast in both languages. And it just sensitized me more to what you ask. I think I have to be aware. Most of the concepts are global, but some of the ways you express them need to be adjusted.
I think that's true of many, many lessons. And I think, you know, because my focus at Humor That Works, we focus on our leadership and communication angles around using more humor and levity in the workplace. And a lot of people have asked the question then of like, how does that culturally translate? It's very much similar of a thing where like every culture that we've experienced and that we've worked with in, you know, 100 plus countries, humor exists, but what they find funny and the level to which they feel it's appropriate in the workplace may change. But the concept of like, ultimately, we as humans would rather do something that is fun over not fun. And so if we can add a little bit of that fun to it, it comes into play. And that's, I mean, people have also even joked, because I've done a number of events in Germany, even prior to meeting my wife, and people are like, but stereotypically, they don't have a sense. No, Germans have a great sense of humor, but it's different. It's a little bit more specific, and it might come out at different times. And so, like you said, very much, whether it is a language change or sometimes a generation change or a region change, some of these concepts within leadership that I know you speak about on psychological safety and growth mindset and these things, they're human things, but how you approach them or how they show up might be a little bit different. And so I love that. And yeah, wonderful to have those listeners. We get the same thing of also listeners of, we very much appreciate the feedback of, hey, we listened to this episode and then in this episode, you said this, et cetera. So like we, you know, have that absolute love for things. And the last thing that I'll say is what you talked about, this difference between but and is a core principle of improvisation. In improv, you learn yes and as a phrase, as opposed to just yes, but. And I think even culturally, even in the US, it's kind of just that distinction of like when you're in a critical mindset versus when you're in a more creative or collaborative mindset, and both can work, but knowing when to say it and does tend to create more of that collaborative feel or that more connect. Like, hey, yeah, now we're all riffing, now we're all together, as opposed to like, but can feel like, well, that was aggressive or that was like, that's dampening the mood a little bit. So a wonderful kind of thing to recognize. So, I mean, I have one more question around podcasting as we start to then wrap up. The question is just like, you know, I think I have a little bit of an idea based on what you talked about, but what keeps you going 370 plus episodes later and you're still, you know, looking for content, or you said, oh, hey, from our conversation, we might be writing ideas down, et cetera. What drives a sense to, like you said, there's a cost and a time and investment. Why keep it going?
The unprompted qualitative reactions of people. I mean, yes, I am glad and very positively surprised to see that more than 13,000 downloaded this podcast last June. So the numbers are exceeded my expectations. But what is much more important than those numbers is moments. For example, we've worked with about 10,000 leaders in these years. One of them, a senior VIP here in Switzerland, a hockey professional, having been 21 years goalie running the national teams. One morning, calls me. I'm on my bike around the lake, and he gives me a call and says, Stefan, I'm just in the Czech Republic. I'm driving home to Switzerland. And the only reason I'm calling you is to tell you how much I appreciate your podcast. I've just listened to three again. And then when we met the next time, he showed me his iPhone, opened up his podcast app, and just screened up about 10 screens. And all that showed up was Lightwolf podcasts. He eats them. He loves them. And this moment is a moment that I really highly appreciate. And it's so valuable to get that one person genuine feedback. Or about a month or two ago, someone posted on LinkedIn, Valerie from Fuchs Job. Hi, Valerie, if you listen to this. He just posted unpromptedly on LinkedIn the lessons he had learned just from listening to that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or someone who said, I've been working for P&G for 5 years. I've been working for company X for 10 years. I've had about 5 different leadership trainings here and none of them was bad. But honestly, Stefan, what I've learned about leadership from listening to your podcast is much more and much more valuable than the learnings I've drawn from these 5 leadership trainings. Yeah? Unquote. So these kind of statements are what keeps me going. And in fact, I have a vision, which is another one that keeps me going. I have a genuine vision, Drew. The vision is simple. I would like to contribute to a well-led world. Why? Some profound and some simpler reasons. Profound? If the world was consistently well-led, we would have no more wars. And happening more frequently, as soon as the world is well-led, many more people will come home from work on many more days with a smile on their face. And that's what keeps me driving, what keeps me going, because it works. It seems to be a helpful part of more and more people's lives. And unlike I thought at the beginning, after the first few months, Drew, I thought about, wow, what will I do once I've done 100? I will run out of ideas. Mm-hmm. In fact, the exact opposite is true. The more I do, the more new ideas I get, right? I've started creating techniques not to lose them. Like I have a WhatsApp channel called Lightwolf just for me, where I'm speaking ideas into just to make sure that I don't lose them. And in fact, the more I do, the more new ideas I have. That keeps me going.
Yeah. The opportunity to get out there and share them. And I think that's, you know, beautiful perspective. I mean, one from a creative angle, that's the same, very, very much the same true for me in terms of writing keynotes or even more so newsletters and comedy, even like as I'm writing stand-up material, et cetera, like you start to explore an idea and initially you're like, one idea leads to like, oh, and then I could explore that. And then I could go into deeper detail here. I could talk about this thing. Like, yeah, I think people are a little bit worried, hey, I'm going to run out of creativity or I'm going to run out of ideas. But no, new ideas create more ideas and living life kind of creates those ideas as well. So I think that's wonderful perspective. And I think there's also a very powerful lesson for people listening to this around what you said is one, holding on to those pieces of feedback that you get from people. I do it as well, like whether it is people who have responded to, you know, this podcast or the TEDx talk that I've done or other things, you know, I put them in a file. And anytime that I'm starting to like, this is too hard or I don't want to do it, et cetera, I can go back and see that kind of motivation. It kind of keeps you going. And it's very nice to understand and learn the impact that you have on people. And so I think for people listening, one, hold on to those moments when you get that feedback, if it's an email or someone pulls you aside, et cetera, because it can help you to keep going as you're thinking about things. But also the value of just a quick reach out. So if someone does something for you, whether it's someone that you know personally and they do something like a quick thank you for like, I really appreciate the way you stood up for me in that meeting or the way that you always come prepared or whatever, that small component of recognition. But it is also true of things like content creators. Like I think, you know, if there is a person who you listen to their podcast consistently or you see their videos online that you enjoy, et cetera, you know, a small gift that you can give to that creator is to say, hey, thank you for this. This has meant a lot because it is the, you know, at least as a creator myself, I read pretty much all of those things and they are the reminders where, like you said, the big numbers and the metrics are very nice, but it's knowing that you're actually having an impact that is really, really powerful. And then that's the last thing I would say is, again, part of our framing of this has been, you know, for leaders to think about, should they be on a podcast as a guest or a host or otherwise, is the reality is like, at least for me personally, and my guess is you might be similar, is that, you know, if you knew that each podcast was only going to help one person, but you knew it was going to help them in a profound way or meaningful way, you would still do it even just for that one person. At least I know that I do. So you just never know kind of how that information is going to get out there and help other people. And so a wonderful way to reflect of why this keeps going and also why the Learnings from Leaders podcast continues as well. So as we've got to wrap up, I want to ask just a couple of fun questions as we tend to do as a way to answer with a couple of quick answers from your side. So you mentioned a couple of comments. Has there been a favorite reaction or comment that you've gotten because of the podcast, maybe in addition to the hockey player?
Stefan, listening to the Lightwolf podcast is by far the best learning experience in my life. It really changed how I live, unquote, coming from a teacher.
Oh, wow. That is a great comment. I like it. Those are the ones that keep you going. Since you are hosting a podcast, if you could interview anyone, you had your pick and they absolutely 100% said yes, whether living or deceased, who would you have a conversation with?
Great question. I'd like to answer by first making a statement. What I like about this question and the answer I'm going to give is that it gives an example. I would hesitate for all of us to look too much to individual people. I think we should not only talk about leaders like the two ones I'm going to cite. We should also talk about leadership as a concept. Because in my life, everyone can be a leader and everyone should be a leader, starting as an intern. Let's not put them on too high a pedestal, like unreachable, unattainable idols. They also started young. They also lived in a human life. But to answer your question, two people I would really like to have a conversation with are Barack Obama and Mahatma Gandhi. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama, I just saw him again here in Zurich last April from a 20-meter distance with 15,000 people in the hall. But there are some things that I really like in the way he leads and thinks. No one is perfect. Everyone makes mistakes. Probably he too. But I think the way he thinks and speaks and makes me listen to him has something quite exceptional that I'd like to learn from. And the other one is Mahatma Gandhi. Referring back to the lesson with the wolf, yeah, where I'm exposing my face to a wolf group that grew up in the wild. I think I'm convinced now that humans mirror human behavior. And I know since I was adopted by this fact that even wolves mirror human behavior. And Mahatma Gandhi led by peaceful behavior. Mm-hmm. You can call him naive, but he was impactful. He led by peaceful behavior. Again, I'm not naive. I think it's somehow in mankind. There is an evil part in mankind. There is an even evil part in me. It's probably naive to assume that we could have peace without weapons, as much as I wish we could. Mm-hmm. But if the world had more humans that live with the respect of Mahatma Gandhi and the respect he signaled to others, in brackets, I'm also a member of a supervisory board of an organization called Reboot the Future, which is all about spreading respect and sustainability in the world, I think the world would be a better place. Also, if some leaders were to risk to be vulnerable, to signal peace rather than confrontation, I think the world would be a better place. So these two would be my choice.
Great examples for that for multiple reasons. And I like the framing also of like not necessarily put on pedestals, because I think that, you know, at least certainly from our conversations on Learnings from Leaders, we've had some great ones with very well-known established leaders that people have known from. And we've also learned some incredible lessons from people who were more junior in their career that maybe not people that didn't have the same kind of brand name recognition, but still had wonderful insights. So I love that as a framing of it. And last question, this is more of a personal one. What's your take on spaghetti ice?
I love it. I love ice cream and I love spaghetti, so there is no way around spaghetti ice for me. I've had the best ever ice cream. I hope I'm not upsetting anyone, but I've had the best ever ice cream of my life up in Tuscany, in Italy, in a place called Castel San Gimignano. The ice cream was absolutely terrific. They won the world championship title. And I love spaghetti. Honestly, again, hopefully not upsetting the French. For me, it could also be eating like God in Italy. I love spaghetti. Mm-hmm. So when loving ice cream and loving spaghetti, I need to have it.
Yeah, well, you put it together. I love it. Yeah. So, I mean, growing up in Cincinnati, I have to say that my favorite ice cream is Grater's, but I will say the thing that I have loved experiencing in Germany is spaghetti ice, which is, for those listening that have not heard of it, is a combo thing. It is taking ice cream, you put it through a spaghetti strainer to make it look like spaghetti, then you put strawberry topping on top for what would be the sauce and shredded white chocolate over top of that. And I've never experienced it or heard anyone that knew about it outside of Germany, but a wonderful gift there. So, as we close, Devin, a wonderful conversation. Our last question for you is just what's one final piece of advice or challenge that you'd give to the next generation of leaders?
I think the one piece of advice I would give is figure out who you want to become. It's legitimate to ask yourself, what am I capable of? But to me, that's the second, if at all, most important question. The most important question to me is, what do I want? Who do I want to become? And then just self-reflect. Don't just assume. When I am asked, what would I do differently if I led my life again? Is my biggest mistake is the black hole of assumptions. It's not enough to have a good intention, as I assume all of us do, but it's about the impact we have on others. You used the word impact as well a couple of times throughout our conversation. So reflect, but not about your intention, reflect your real impact on others. And I think as you keep on exploring those two avenues on who do I want to be, what do I want, and what is my real impact on others by doing it this way, you can't prevent being happier every year and more effective as a leader every year. That would be my advice.
Fantastic. I think a great piece of advice. Well, Stefan, thank you so much for joining this episode of Learnings from Leaders. Yeah, thanks for a great conversation.
A privilege to be your guest. Fun to be your guest. Thank you very much, dear Drew.
And that's our show. Like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment in communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
That's it for this week. I've been Andrew Tarvin.
And I'm still Ruman Segal. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.